Most of the Earth's landmass is way too brittle to be cropped. There's a lot of people that have some pretty shallow thinking about how animals are raised. You know, I mean, if you just look at an image of cows out on pasture versus a monocrop field of wheat, I think it's pretty obvious just by looking at it. How can these cows possibly be so damaging to the environment? There's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of people skewing data in their favor in order to back up a very emotional decision that they don't want animals to die in order to support their health. And the fact is, everything is eaten and needs to be. And so life and death are happening at every second because that's just the way nature works. You know, having a really healthy pasture-based animal system is going to sequester a lot more carbon.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
You know, I look at all the discussions about sustainability and nutrition almost as if you're looking at a river and picking where you're going to jump in that river. Well, there's a confluence of rivers that are coming together, and increasingly it's combining both sustainability and concern about sustainability and nutrition. I mean, it was tried not too long ago with dietary guidelines to say whether the dietary guidelines should include, you know, sustainability and where it fits into the whole scheme of things. Well, it's hard to ignore the fact that there is interest and concern about how you eat nutritionally correct and how you do what you need to do for your body and for your family, and also what's right for the planet. But my guest today finds herself in the middle of those conversations all the time. I'm really pleased to welcome to Farm to Table Talk Diana Rogers with Sustainable Dish. Diana, thank you for taking the time to visit with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You know, you spend a lot of time talking about these issues. Mm-hmm. You have a blog, you have clients. Explain, where do you come from, where does this perspective come from in you? What's brought you to looking at this nexus of nutrition and sustainability and putting your practice and your conversations kind of right squarely into that whole area?
Sure. Well, I guess for me, it all started with a nutrition quest. I was an undiagnosed sufferer from celiac disease, which is a gluten intolerance. Probably most people today know what that is. I used to have to explain it, but it's an autoimmune condition where your body reacts very strongly to gluten. And I didn't find out until I was about 26. And at the time, I went to my dietitian at a major Boston hospital, and she just gave me a bunch of coupons for gluten-free food and told me to just, you know, swap out everything I was eating and just include gluten-free substitutes for everything. So I went from what I thought was pretty healthy, which was, you know, a piece of toast in the morning, maybe some gluten-free cereal, a gluten-free sandwich for lunch, and maybe some gluten-free pasta, and I still was not feeling great. So a lot of my stomach distress was gone, but my blood sugar issues were still all over the place. I was actually in what they call metabolic syndrome, which is sort of that step right before you reach type 2 diabetes, even though I've never been overweight, but I've just always had just, you know, basically hypoglycemia really badly. I kept asking my doctors to test me for diabetes, and the tests were sort of always within quote-unquote normal range, but I knew things weren't right because I needed snacks just constantly, you know, or else I'd get what I call hangry, so like angry and hungry at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I always had my gluten-free granola bars on me at all times. And I had a career at the time in natural food marketing. So I worked for a couple of companies and then for Whole Foods Market doing marketing for them. So I've always been interested in food. And in my summers during high school and college, I would work on an organic farm. So I've always been interested in that. my husband at the same time kind of had a similar path, but into farming, where he was very interested in the environment, but didn't know quite what to do with himself professionally. So he ended up going from an environmental studies major to an English major, just because he wasn't sure how to make a career out of his passion for the environment. And while we were living on the West Coast after college with our corporate jobs, at a very young age, he just couldn't do it. He couldn't work in an office, in a cubicle, wearing a tie every day. He just hated it. And we learned about CSAs back in the mid-90s. So it was just kind of, they were just sort of starting out. And he read a book by Wendell Berry called The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture.
I'm going to pause, but let me pause right there, because, you know, it's so often I've heard, you know, various stories, and Wendell Berry has seemed to be an inspiration for so many people.
I know.
Have you ever done an interview with him?
I haven't, but I did get a chance to meet him, and my son got a chance to meet him, our 13-year-old boy, this summer when he spoke out in the Berkshires here in Massachusetts. It was really great. But no, I haven't had a chance to interview him yet.
No, I haven't either, and I hope to someday, because I remember the first time I think I heard Michael Pollan answering some questions about what his inspiration was. And he credited Wendell Berry right off the bat. And obviously we know Michael Pollan went on to make something of himself, and but Wendell Berry kind of inspired him. So I interrupted you, but I just thought I had to note that. And I'm going to want to circle back too, and you're on the West Coast. I mean, the other inspiration you had, other than being gluten-free, was all those things that organic implies in the mm-hmm. production as well. But let me get you back on track then again. You were just about saying that you were looking at...
Oh, I can talk and talk and talk for hours, so please
sure,
interrupt me.
Sure, I will.
Yeah, so we were living on the West Coast. We had our, you know, quote-unquote jobs, making money, and we could afford an apartment. But I was okay. I was working in advertising, and I felt like it was kind of fun. But my husband really was quite miserable. He was my boyfriend at the time, so we met when we were 19.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, so he decided, I'm going to be a farmer. That's the end of it. And so he had no farming background at all, English major in college, and at the age of 25, he made this declaration. And so we got his company to transfer him back to Massachusetts, where he quickly quit and entered the master's degree program in soil science at the University of Massachusetts, where we both went for undergrad. And so he wanted to learn kind of the science behind agriculture, but then also he got a job for like $5 an hour on a farm, learning how to drive the tractor and do all that hands-on stuff. And then quickly he was hired to be a farm manager on the North Shore of Massachusetts, working for the daughter-in-law of the famous General George Patton. And so we were there for 10 years, and he ran the farm there. And at the halfway through our stay there, I had our second child and realized that working crazy hours for Whole Foods was just not consistent with how I wanted to raise my kids. It was, you know, really demanding, and I didn't want them in daycare all the time. And so I started helping out at the farm, and I ran our kitchen, I ran the CSA, and I started getting a lot of questions. We had a farm store, which I ran, from people saying, well, why do you sell coconut oil? Because I thought that saturated fats were bad, and I really don't understand. And I had read a few books on it, but I really didn't fully grasp why. And that, coupled with my blood sugar issues, really drove me to learn more about nutrition. And so
what was your educational training and preparation up to that point?
Well, up until then, I had a bachelor's degree in fine arts.
Oh, perfect. English, yeah. And fine arts.
Yeah, fine arts, art education. So mm-hmm. I have a certificate to teach art. Which still comes into play now that I'm a mom, and I do a lot of painting on the side. But So I had never studied before. I had never taken a biochemistry class or any of the classes that I, you know, dove into. And I really decided that I needed to learn more about nutrition. I didn't know if I was going to do it for a career. So what I did first was I attended a program called Nutritional Therapy Association. Have you heard of that?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So they're based in Oregon, but they've mm-hmm. got distance learning programs, and it was really great. It was sort of a nice introduction for me, and it's very centered on the Weston A. Price, you know, whole foods, butter is good, full fat things are good, and I had to hear it's okay to eat butter like 100 times before I actually would eat butter. So that was really interesting. I opened a practice, a nutrition practice, and I should back up. When I was at Nutritional Therapy Association, I had to do a book report towards the end, and I decided to read this new book that had just come out called The Paleo Solution by Rob Wolf,
mm-hmm.
and I decided to give it a try. The prescription in this book was to go 30 days with no grains and no dairy and no sugar and no alcohol. So I was nervous because I was so carb addicted in my granola bars and my gluten-free pasta and everything. But it was like my life went from like black and white to Technicolor. It was amazing. And I could go from breakfast to lunch without a snack. I could skip lunch and be fine and not have a headache and feel shaky. And it really just, I lost this like last 10 pounds that I had been holding on from my pregnancy. And everything just came into perfect focus. And so when I opened my nutrition practice, lo and behold, every single person that walked into my office was benefiting from this way of eating. Every single person. So I decided to learn more about it and get the medical credential, registered dietitian, which was basically a lot more school, being trained in sort of the classic, American Dietetics Association, mm-hmm. eat low fat, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of answered all the questions, went through the classes, answered all the questions how I thought they were supposed to be, how they were expecting them to be answered, not the answers that I would give. So that was quite challenging for me, but I finished it. I'm a registered dietitian now, but I still focus on mostly just real food, whether it's paleo or just kind of just getting back to basics, Mediterranean-style diet, but incorporating, animal proteins as the main source of protein and natural healthy fats like butter and avocado and coconut oil as the main fats, and keeping it relatively low, low carb in general seems to work for most people. So that's just kind of how it's all come together. And because we live on an organic farm, it just marriages perfectly with the food that we grow here. So we do pasture-based animal farming and organic vegetable farming. We run a CSA. And so I end up talking a lot at nutrition conferences about the benefits of sustainable agriculture. And then when I go to sustainable agriculture conferences, I talk about the benefits of pasture-raised meats and real food.
Boy, wow. That's a great journey. And one you anticipated, I think, question I was going to raise, didn't have to, because if you went ahead and became a registered dietitian, because I do know that there's a certain amount of kind of friction between sometimes people that are working in nutrition but don't have the RD, but you check that box. I mean, you've come at it differently than some people have,
mm-hmm.
and ended up, you have a registered dietitian and you're the nutritionist and you've had this experience with organic. It's What a great background. And then to be on an organic farm, too. Now, when you were saying that all the things that you started your diet, it was no grain, no sugar, no alcohol, and what else was it? No
dairy.
No dairy, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Which is hard by itself. Now, you add to the fact that you're also are an organic farm. So are you Have you continued to do the no grain, no sugar, no alcohol, and no dairy?
So that's the 30-day elimination diet that you kind of kick off a paleo lifestyle with. But nobody tends, I mean, unless they have really, you know, big health problems or, you know, food, you know, reactions to these foods. Most people who start off this way end up incorporating maybe like an 80-20 type rule where 80% of their diet mm-hmm. is still mainly meat and vegetables, pretty low carb. But then the other 20% may be some, you know, cheese, a little oatmeal, some rice, so other healthy
foods. It's a little bit less extreme.
Yeah, so I'll have a drink once in a while. Sometimes I'll order a creme brulee at a restaurant. But in general, I feel my best when I'm, you know, sticking closest to this way of eating.
You know, the thing I always found was a little tricky was when people start saying that they're against carbs, and I think, well, you know, broccoli is carbs, and you can't mm-hmm. possibly, you can hardly eat too much broccoli. So aren't they just talking about, you know, mainly breads and pastas and things like that?
Yeah, so according to the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, for my weight and height and activity level, I should be eating, you know, in excess of 300 grams of carbs a day. And if I ate that many carbs, I would be very, very sick, and I would have diabetes right now. I can guarantee you that. So I try to keep my carbohydrate intake between, like, 75 to 100 grams of carbs a day, so that... Mm-hmm. That kind of looks like this. Breakfast might be an omelet with some vegetables. I tend not to have a lot of carbohydrate with my breakfast because I just feel better that way. I've found with most people if they do have that extra piece of fruit or toast with breakfast, they're hungrier sooner because mm-hmm. it can, you know, starting off the day with pretty low blood sugar from fasting all night, mm-hmm. it's kind of nice to not really spike that blood sugar with some French toast or pancakes.
Mm-hmm.
Lunch might be some leftover stew from the night before or a big salad with, you know, like a 6-ounce piece of fish or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then add some avocado for some healthy fats that'll keep you full for a long time. And then dinner sort of looks like maybe what you would have had in the 1940s or 50s, like a pork chop, a baked sweet potato, and about half my plate full of vegetables.
Now, is it possible to overeat vegetables and carbs? Because, I mean, you said like 300 carbs a day. I mean, how much would you have to eat just, you know, broccoli and carrots and those things?
So, I mean, broccoli is pretty low in carbohydrates. So the things that are higher in starch would have more carbohydrate. So potato, about 50 grams of carbs would get you about a little over one potato, to give you a sense of that. So that's 50 grams of carbs.
Well, that's my point, is that the generalization about carbs and saying I'm on a low-carb diet, I always want to say, okay, now qualify your carbs here because... maybe it's quantity I'm getting at rather than the amount of the carbs. Because, again, filling your plate with vegetables, got to be a good thing. People should do a lot of it, more than they do, I would think.
But, yeah, so generally the vegetables that have carbs are potatoes, sweet potatoes, carrots and beets, and, you know, other root crop type vegetables.
Right.
But really it's pretty unlimited as far as leafy greens, broccoli, that kind of stuff. Unless you're on a very restricted, very low carb diet, like a ketogenic diet, and then you are counting things like onions. But I tend not to go that extreme with most people unless there's a medical requirement for that.
Well, what about on the grains? I mean, back at paleo and you're pulling back on the grains, but gluten-free, there are a lot of grains that are gluten-free.
Mm-hmm.
Are they better for you than in your mind than those that have gluten, like the wheat products?
Well, so there's several reasons, and that's where we can pull in sustainability to talk about this. And
sure.
Also, because so from a sustainability perspective, monocropping, you know, vast, you know, fields full of wheat or corn is just not great, right? Environmentally speaking, we want to have lots of diversity. We want to have lots of grazing animals, which actually can help sequester carbon instead of draining the soil of its nutrients by, you know, using monocrop farming methods. So that's one, is just grains in general just are not, sustainability speaking, a good thing.
But you can rotate grains. I mean, I grew up on a farm that back in, you know, when I was young, we always rotated. You mean you had corn one year, and then you had oats, and then you had alfalfa, and you know, ran cattle out there, and we spread manure on the fields, and so you don't have to be kind of extreme monoculture. But I agree with you that, you know, there's a lot of it now.
Yes, there is, and I probably couldn't pick one package off the shelf that was grown in the way you just described.
Yeah, well, that's too bad.
Yeah, and then as far as gluten. So wheat has really transformed a lot since it was sort of first introduced to the human diet. We made it shorter with more seed pods. We intensified the gluten content of it, and you know, people are eating them in highly processed forms. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Is, you know, people really aren't eating whole grains. They're eating processed food with all the nutrients stripped out and then fortified back in.
Like white bread, like Wonder Bread or something, that wasn't it back in the 30s that we thought that it was such a magical thing that they figured out how to mass produce white bread, but they took most of the good stuff out of it?
Yeah, but still today, even wheat bread, that's highly, highly processed.
Mm.
So I don't feel that it's really a nutrient-dense food. If you were looking at nutrient density and you really want, you know, okay, I'm going to eat, let's say, 2,000 calories a day and I want the maximum nutrient density with the most vitamins and minerals, it's not going to include grains. So if you just purely even look at, you know, what's the best bang for your buck? Well, if I'm going to invest my money and my caloric intake in a healthy diet and you look at it from a scientific perspective, you're much better off with roots and tubers for your starch intake than you are from a grain intake.
Even things like quinoa and spelt and some of those more exotic ancient grains?
Yes.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're being promoted as alternatives, of course.
Yeah. Well, and then the other thing, too, is that there's a lot of components within grain that actually block nutrient absorption. So there's things called anti-nutrients. Grains, just like all vegetables and plants, have defense mechanisms to prevent us from eating them and digesting them so that they can be seeds growing in the ground. Mm-hmm. And so if you've ever eaten corn on the cob, that's a perfect example of how those corn kernels want to stay like corn kernels. They don't want to be digested. And as they're going through our digestive system, all grains are sort of releasing these little chemicals that are causing. I'm trying to dumb this down so it's not too scientific. So I apologize. I'm struggling
right
here. But basically, they're blocking nutrient absorption and they're causing inflammation in our bodies. And you know, people are just really better off limiting them. So you know, I don't think everyone has to completely eliminate them. But we are eating way too many grains.
And that includes rice?
That includes rice.
Well, let's switch over to the organic side. I started to get into that a little bit ago because you've also, you're an organic farm. Do you eat primarily certified organic?
Well, yes, because we live on a certified organic farm, and so I'm not going to go to the grocery store and buy string beans when we have string beans here. So I generally eat the food that we grow here on the farm because it's more economical, it's fresher, it tastes better, and it's healthier. In the winter, our vegetable consumption definitely is more varied, and I try to buy organic as much as I can. So I do buy some non-organic things, but in general, it's mostly organic vegetables. And then as far as the meat goes, our meat is not certified organic, but it is pasture-raised, and when we do feed them grain, it's a certified organic non-soy grain. So like, for example, our pigs are raised out on pasture, but they are supplemented with grain. And so I feel really good about eating the pork from our farm and not so great about eating the pork from,
well, what's the,
you know,
reason,
a CAFO.
What's the reason that you support organic? Why have you chosen to be both an organic farmer but mostly consume organic?
Well, th- there's the environmental reasons for, you know, wanting to, you know, have, I mean, I think organic's a pretty outdated term at this point, and I think regenerative is sort of the new...
Well, that's what I was going to get at, because that's there's several things, you know, people talk about permaculture, and people talk about regenerative, and people have, you know, still looking at sustainable, and even I think that there's some controversy right now in organic because there's a move to hydroponics, and the implication had been that organics was founded on having a healthy earth, which also meant how you're taking care of the soil and building the soil back up. And so the critics of having hydroponics qualify for organic are saying, well, are we deserting then trying to maintain and preserve and improve the quality of earth? So there's another, it's confusing to people when they hear things like regenerative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, we have a small scale farm where we rotate everything. We're building organic matter in the soil. We can measure that through soil testing. We can see it through just looking at the soil. So we're pretty pretty integrated here. We're on a pretty small scale. So, you know, organic to me doesn't mean a whole lot as far as you know, soil health or anything. I mean, organic broccoli grown on a 5,000 acre farm is still a monocrop, and it's not going to be as good as something that's grown on a smaller scale farm that's really, you know, got a lot of biodiversity going on. So, you know, I always encourage people to, you know, buy directly from a small scale farm that's using a lot of really great techniques like rotation with animals and you know, rotating the crops around and also exposing, you know, doing education like we do here at the farm, exposing young people to how their food is grown.
Well, and I assume a lot of people that are motivated for organic, it's to reduce pesticide use and both the effect on the environment potentially and residues that still might be on the foods that they eat.
Well, I think most people are mostly just concerned about their own bodies and how the, you know, chemicals are going to affect themselves. So that's generally, you know, when you see these silly lists like the Clean 15 and the Dirty Dozen or whatever, you know, they're not taking anything other than, you know, chemical on the food into consideration. They're not really looking at the environment. So it's not really, to me, it's that's like really junior level thinking.
Let's go over to the livestock for a bit, because it seems like it's gotten more and more controversial that there are people that are making a lot about how we need to worry about climate change, and one of the things we have to do for climate change is have less livestock. How do you deal with those kind of comments?
There's a lot of people that have some pretty shallow thinking about how animals are raised, and, you know, I try to... You know, I mean, if you just look at an image of cows out on pasture versus a monocrop field of wheat, I think it's pretty obvious just by looking at it that, you know, how can these cows possibly be, you know, so damaging to the environment? There's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of people skewing data in their favor in order to back up a very emotional decision that they don't want animals to die in order to support their health. And the fact is, we all need, everything is eaten and needs to be, needs to eat. And so life and death are happening at every second because that's just the way nature works. And so, you know, having a really healthy pasture-based animal system is going to sequester a lot more carbon than any plant-based diet that could possibly be out there.
I remember years ago thinking of how you fly across the country and you look at all the landmass that's beneath us, and so much of it could only be used for grazing. You know, if you really got desperate, I mean, you're able to, you know, graze the strips and in, you know, with ruminant animals, possibly even in the interstate system. I mean, there's forages that are produced that that really only the ruminants can take advantage of.
Right. I mean, most of the Earth's landmass is way too brittle to be cropped. So, for example, think about Africa. So almost all of Africa is way too dry to support, you know, lettuce, broccoli, even most grain production. And so really the only agriculture that really works for that, for most of the landmass is herbivore grazing. And they also happen to be incredibly nutrient dense. We can use their milk, we can use their blood like the Maasai, and we can also eat their meat. So, and while they're grazing, they can actually improve soil health if they're managed properly.
Less so with pigs and chickens. I mean, so the ruminant animals, goats, sheep, and cattle, and even horses, I mean, have the ability to use the, you know, herbivores, as you're saying, but not so much pigs and chickens. I mean, how do you justify the systems that are producing chickens and pigs?
So I don't try to justify industrial scale chickens and pigs. I don't at all. I think that our chicken consumption and the perception that this halo that chickens have around them is really not deserved. On a farm like ours, you know, if we're trying to mimic natural ways, and so we have the grazers come through, and then we follow them with the chickens that we're raising for eggs. Mm-hmm. If you were to go out and look at a natural herd of bison, there's tons of birds following right behind, eating all the little worms and going through, the bison manure. So the birds are very, very effective at, you know, cleaning up any of sort of the leftovers from the animals, keeping the parasite populations down, and providing nutrient-dense eggs. So, and pigs have their role as well. Pigs are helping us clear the forest land here so we can, open it up and make more cropland. But we're using them in a very specific way. Now, if you're looking at typical production of chickens and pigs, they're 100% indoors, 100% only eating grain, which is not not even close to their natural diet. They never see the outdoors, and, you know, even if they're cage-free, they're still pretty confined and pretty stressed out. If you compare that even to typical beef that has gone to a feedlot, feedlot beef is a much, much better choice than typical pork or chicken, because for the beginning part of that cow's life, and, you know, in many times it's much more than half their life, they're out on pasture, so cows aren't, like, just born on a feedlot and stay there forever. When they go, and they're eating grass, so all these numbers that are saying, oh, well, it takes, you know, it's a 12-to-1 ratio of grain to flesh. They're trying to calculate the entire weight of that cow, but they're not looking at the fact that that cow entered the feedlot at 600 to 900 pounds on grass. So if a cow's finished, the last 600 pounds of it is finished at a feedlot, you can really only calculate that 600 pounds minus the unedible parts that are used in other parts of production. So if you, I went through and crunched the numbers, and cow and chicken are pretty equal as far as grain in, flesh out for edible meat. And then if you think about, you know, the animal welfare perspective, you know, at least these cows on feedlots can walk around. Mm-hmm. They're outdoors. They get sunlight. Mm-hmm. They're not sort of, you know, forced just to stand only in front of their bowl of food all day long so that they can't walk, which is really what's happening in pig and chicken farming.
I would imagine you find yourselves getting into some arguments. I mean, who tends to be, I don't want to ask the individuals' names, but what are some of the criticisms that you have to deal with, or where do you find what's most controversial now about the directions that you suggest for farming and for nutrition?
Well, they're sometimes the same. So there are a lot of vegan folks that are pretty threatened by what I'm saying, and I always recommend that they go after, you know, the cookbook authors and nutritionists and farmers who aren't trying to look at environmental and animal welfare and social justice issues, because those are the things I really care about. So, you know, in fact, I went to a book signing one time in New York City, and I was standing next to two other cookbook authors, and I had a bunch of vegans come up to me, challenging me, but yet these other two cookbook authors would just call for, you know, like boneless, skinless chicken breast in a recipe without any nod at all to food production or sustainability. But yet when I have that in my book and I talk about the good ways to raise animals, I get the criticism. So it's interesting. I definitely never go online and troll vegan sites and try to pick a fight. I generally find that you know, the religious like emotion that they and dogma that they have around their diet is something that any level of science could never sway them. So it's I don't go around trying to talk vegans out of being vegan. It's fine for them to be vegan. I do have a lot of an issue with parents forcing a vegan diet on their children, because that is these kids, you know, can't refuse that. And B12 deficiency, which is very, very common, documented in the vegan population, can cause permanent brain damage in children. And so I am, as a practitioner, as a dietitian, I cannot endorse a vegan diet for babies or children.
You know, I would imagine there'll be somebody hearing this podcast that will make a comment on our Facebook page, because it's happened when I have Joel Salatin, and he does a great job of explaining how he feels about livestock. And I know you've talked to him as well. Mm-hmm. And there's always somebody that feels very strongly on the other side of this perspective. That there have been some policy issues come up, and the USDA, and even in the Farm Bill. I mentioned earlier there was an attempt to tie sustainability into the dietary guidelines, mm-hmm. and it ultimately was pulled back out of the report. Mm-hmm. Is there anything on the horizon as far as policy that you're keeping an eye on, or that you're concerned or interested in, on school lunch recommendations, or any other of those things that may be going on in the federal policy levels?
Well, I mean, it's really hard to predict what kind of crazy things are going to come down now that we've got a new administration in there. So it's just incredibly unpredictable. I was encouraged recently by the USDA. They're taking soil health pretty seriously and sent out a letter to us. And there's been some news stories about they're wanting to have more, you know, regenerative agriculture, more no-till farming, more, you know, land and pasture and that kind of stuff. So that was really impressive and kind of came out of nowhere, at least to me. So that was pretty. That was pretty exciting. As far as nutrition policy, it was pretty nice to see that saturated fat and cholesterol are no longer nutrients of concern. So that's, unfortunately, though, has not actually made it into my plate recommendations. We're still being told to drink low-fat milk, which is one of the dumbest things you can be drinking.
Oh, explain that, would you? Because I hear that back and forth. I mean, it's so hard when you don't buy milk that often. We don't with not having kids at home anymore. But, you know, it just seems natural to grab the skim or the 1% versus the whole milk. Could you explain why the whole milk might be better?
Well, the most nutrient-dense part of milk is the fat-soluble vitamins. So if you take out the fat, you've got pretty much just sugar water with a little bit of protein in it. But, you know, the whole purpose of milk is to put weight on mammals. So it's awesome if you're a calf or if you're a child. I mean, I give my kids full-fat milk because they're growing and they like it. And I find that it's, you know, it can be part of a nutrient-dense diet for them. But I, you know, when I have nutrition clients come in, they're looking to lose weight and reduce inflammation. Dairy can be highly inflammatory. Low-fat dairy is just a loser on every single level.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, we could go on because you have so many interesting things that you're involved with. I think in just kind of wrapping up where you are with your journey, you have a family, you have a farm, You have clients, you have people that are listening to your podcast, that are seeing your, reading your blog. What kind of goals do you have in this coming year? It seems to me like you've got an awful lot accomplished already, and you're walking the talk, and you're helping other people kind of eat nutritionally and sustainably. What are you hoping for in this, in the next couple of years?
Yeah, well, I just started working on a book that hopefully I'll have, you know, out at about next year at this time, if all goes well. Basically outlining what diet is optimal for human health and the environment. And it basically is going to be all these things we've talked about before and just on this podcast. So just sort of defending healthy fats and animal proteins as not only perfect for human health, but also can be beneficial if raised properly for the environment. So, and I'll be talking a lot about the moral arguments as well, why, you know, things that, you know, that actually I had a good podcast with Joel Salatin recently all about this, but, you know, why, how can you be an ethical omnivore? And, you know, how can you possibly love animals and eat them at the same time? So I'm sort of going to be exploring all those things within this next thing that book that I'm working on. So that's the biggest project that I've got going on. But I continue to do a lot of writing, a lot of speaking. I'm more and more at meat conferences, defending the environmental and nutritional benefits of meat. And then, yeah, keeping with my nutrition practice and being around for my middle school age kids.
Well, I tell you what, you've got your schedule filled up. I'm glad you just took some time to visit with us this morning. I really appreciate Diana Rogers being on Farm to Table Talk. Diana, thank you for talking to us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Farm to Table Talk is supported by Larda Institute's Ag Innovation Showcase. With the pandemic upending supply chains, the economic health and well-being of farms and farmers, and the continued assault on food and agriculture, we need to move rapidly towards regenerative agriculture. Solutions are within our grasp when all stakeholders are unbridled by notions of what is possible and committed to what is necessary. To find energized ideas for the future of food and farming, go to agshowcase.com. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk.